So if you've noticed the trend of the day, we've gone from things that are more theoretical and more policy to more technical, more applied. We're kind of working our way up and out of the Safe Drinking Water Act basics to above and beyond the Safe Drinking Water Act. And the reason we do that is to really, it's a direct correlation with the amount of food and beverages consumed. Things that are theoretical policy are better absorbed on an empty stomach. And as you know, as MGWO works very hard to rectify that situation, we kind of move the teams towards more applied and things in the field. Apparently, there's more capacity to absorb those as stomachs are satiated. So that's kind of the theme, conference hack for you. Thank you for future organizers. But on a serious note, my great pleasure to introduce Jane DeLambert, our last speaker of the day. And thank you, Jane, for being the last speaker of the day, also putting up with this. And Jane's going to talk about this strange contradiction of the Safe Drinking Water Act. We actually have a regulation that has to do with unregulated contaminants. The Safe Drinking Water Act actually regulates unregulated things. So that's one of the interesting paradoxes in the rule. And Jane will talk about how the Drinking Water Program Department of Health tries to account for that and a little bit go beyond the Safe Drinking Water Act. With that, Jane DeLambert.
Thanks, Sandeep, and thanks, everyone, for sticking around for the last talk of the day. I'm Jane DeLambert. I'm an environmental research scientist in the Source Water Protection Unit within Drinking Water Protection at MDH, and I'm going to be talking about how we've been working to incorporate unregulated contaminant monitoring and monitoring for contaminants of emerging concern into our public water supply program at MDH. So I have several projects and programs I'm going to go through today. The first is the Unregulated Contaminants Monitoring Project, or UCMP. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about some cyanazine degradate monitoring that we've done at public water systems. Then I'll talk about the statewide PFAS testing project for community public water systems. And then lastly, I'll finish with the new initiative that we have within the program called the Drinking Water Ambient Monitoring Program. So the Unregulated Contaminants Monitoring Project, or UCMP, began in 2019, not to be confused with UCMR, which is the EPA's monitoring that's done every 5 years for emerging contaminants. So the goal of UCMP was to test for a wide range of contaminants of emerging concern in drinking water sources and in finished drinking water to identify any public potential public health concerns, to be able to compare the results between source water and finished water, and to evaluate if results were different in geologically vulnerable sources versus those that are not considered to be geologically vulnerable. This was an LCCMR project funded by the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. We sampled both groundwater and surface water systems, and the groundwater systems were split into two categories, those that might be potentially impacted by agricultural land use and those that might be impacted by wastewater discharge. So we sampled approximately 80 public water systems in phase one of this project, which included surface water and groundwater systems. And we used several different criteria to select systems to participate in this project. So one of those criteria was looking at past water quality indicators. To select agriculture-impacted systems, we looked at past pesticide results, high nitrate, where we had veterinary pharmaceutical data or bovine bacteroides, which was from the pathogen project that Jim just presented on. So in some cases, we had that data available to help us in selecting systems. For the wastewater-impacted systems, we looked at past chloride data, chloride-bromide ratios, bacteria, nitrate, pharmaceutical data where available. Then we also looked at land use surrounding the wells and public water systems. So for the agriculture systems, we looked at the number and type of cultivated crops within the drinking water supply management areas, number of feedlots surrounding the wells. For the wastewater impacted systems, we looked at number of septic systems surrounding wells and the age and locations of wastewater treatment plants, in addition to geologic sensitivity and geologic vulnerability. We also looked at geographic considerations. We wanted to have a representative sample of wells and public water systems across the state in different geographic locations, different geologic conditions. We did convene a technical advisory team to help guide the project, and especially in our parameter selection. and we had members from multiple agencies. We partnered with the USGS on this project, and we also had members from MPCA and MDA, as well as within different groups at MDH. So we tailored each list of parameters to the different networks that we had. As many of you know, it's expensive to sample for CECs, so we targeted our list based on where we were sampling. So at surface water systems, typically being the most vulnerable, we sampled for the widest range of contaminants. We sampled for pharmaceuticals, pesticides, wastewater indicators, personal care products, alkyl phenols, benzotriazoles, hormones, PFAS, and illicit drugs. At wastewater impacted systems, we focused on pharmaceuticals, wastewater indicators, and PFAS. And then at agriculture impacted systems, we focused primarily on pesticides. In phase two of the project, we added in a non-vulnerable well comparison group. So we selected wells that were in areas where the land use would indicate that they may be vulnerable to wastewater discharge or to agricultural chemicals, but the wells themselves were considered to be geologically non-vulnerable. We also revisited the agriculture network and sampled those wells for PFAS and for total cyanazine, which is cyanazine plus its associated degradates. We had two samplers that collected all the samples for this project. Ariana's on the left, and she's here today. Natalia's on the right. They collected all the samples together for phase one, which ran from August 2019 to November of 2019. And then in phase two, Ariana collected all of the samples herself, and that ran from September to December of 2021. So the next couple slides show some of the aggregated results that we received as a part of this work. People tend to love or hate these types of graphics, so I hope that they're useful to some folks. But basically what this graphic shows is the color of the circles are showing which CEC class they belong to. So the dark blue are pesticides, PFAS are in red, benzotriazoles are orange, and so on. And then the size of the circle equates to how frequently the contaminant was detected. So just looking at this graph, you can see that we had one inorganic compound, that's lithium, that was detected very frequently. We also had some wastewater indicators. Tribromomethane is another one, or bromoform, that was detected very frequently. And then we also see a lot of pesticides, some benzotriazoles. And I'll mention, overall, we sampled for 522 different CECs, and of those, we detected 161. So we did have quite a few detections, but when compared to how many CECs we sampled for, it was actually a pretty small percentage. So this next chart shows our 10 most frequently detected CECs across the study. Again, lithium is up there. Bromoform, then we have a few different pesticides, PFBA, PFHXS, where our two PFAS included in the top 10. Then this slide shows the CECs that were detected in at least 20% of samples, just to get a different way to look at some of our most frequently detected compounds. We had 11 different pesticides, 7 PFAS, 1 inorganic compound, that's lithium again, 2 different wastewater indicators, 2 pharmaceuticals, and 2 benzotriazoles. So takeaways from this project were that very few samples actually exceeded any health-based guidance values that we have for CECs. Only a fraction of the CECs analyzed for were detected. Pesticides and PFAS were generally detected at higher frequencies than the other CECs. And the CEC concentrations were generally higher in the non-vulnerable settings compared to the non-vulnerable settings. So next steps on this work, we did complete a data summary report that's available on our website if you're interested in looking a little bit more into the details of the project and more of the data. But we are continuing to partner with USGS on a couple of technical papers to do more advanced statistical analysis and really get to the bottom of some of our initial research questions were, is there a significant difference between the CECs that we're seeing between groundwater and surface water, between source and finished water, between our different land use settings and between the vulnerable and non-vulnerable geologic settings. We're also interested in looking at how mixtures of contaminants might affect human health risks, so we'll also be looking into that a little bit more. And we did collect a lot of general chemistry data along with the CEC samples, so doing some more analysis with that data as well. So I'm jumping around here a lot, but our next on my list was the cyanazine degradant monitoring at public water systems, which really began in 2020, and that's been ongoing. So a little bit of a background. Cyanazine is considered a chlorotriazine herbicide, was used in Minnesota from the 1970s to the 1990s. It is no longer used. Exposure to cyanazine degradants can induce reproductive effects, neuroendocrine and renal effects, other health health issues. This chart shows some of the cyanazine-specific degradants and then some of the degradants that are common to both cyanazine and atrazine. So we do have health-based guidance values for total cyanazine, which is basically the sum of cyanazine plus any of the detected degradants. So the acute health risk limit is 3 micrograms per liter, and the chronic HRL is 1 microgram per liter. So this flowchart shows the kind of the process that we go through in sampling public water systems for cyanazine degradants. MDA has really led the charge on cyanazine degradant monitoring. They've really been the leaders, and we've kind of looked to them for how we should handle cyanazine degradant testing at public water systems. So they've done a lot of widespread testing of total cyanazine in townships that are vulnerable to nitrate contamination. And we have an interagency agreement where we meet regularly, and they then share those results with MDH. And we use that data from their private well testing to conduct a proximity analysis and identify any public water system wells that are within 1 mile of any elevated result that they receive from their testing. We then go out and sample the public water system wells and then share results with systems and resample if there is an elevated result. We have sampled approximately 90 public water systems for total cyanazine at this point, and we have had one of the 90 that has had an elevated result, and that was in the source water, and the finished water sample was actually below the HRL, but we're still working on doing continued follow-up sampling with that system, and that is a transient non-community system. So next project on my list is the statewide PFAS testing project of community water systems. This began in 2020 and just wrapped up in early 2023. So the goals of this project were to sample all community public water supplies by early 2023 for PFAS. Participation was voluntary for systems since PFAS are not currently regulated. We wanted to sample all entry points at each community water system, and we wanted to determine if any detections were above MDH health guidance values, and just to get a sense of the occurrence and distribution of PFAS in Minnesota drinking water. So phase one of this project began in June of 2021 and ran through September. We sampled approximately 100 community water systems for PFAS. And although the goal was to sample all community systems in the state for PFAS, we wanted to target our efforts by sampling the systems first that might be more vulnerable to being contaminated by PFAS. So at first, in this first phase, we sampled only systems that were nearby known sources or detections of PFAS in the environment, and we also targeted our sampling efforts on geologically vulnerable sources. This project was funded through an EPA multipurpose grant. We had all of the samples collected by contractors that we coordinated with, and all samples were submitted to the MDH Public Health Lab and sampled or analyzed under EPA Method 533 for PFAS in drinking water. So I mentioned we wanted to target systems that were had nearby known sources or detections of PFAS in the environment. And so we did that by partnering with MPCA, and they were able to share their PFAS data from Equus, so we were able to use that in targeting which public water systems to sample. We also looked at data from sites where AFFF had been used, sites where spray irrigation had been used, and also sampling public water systems that were nearby closed landfills. Phase two of the statewide PFAS testing project began in fall of 2021. And everything was essentially the same for phase two, except that we broadened the scope of the project to not only sample systems that were nearby known sources or detections of PFAS in the environment, but to broaden the scope for systems that we may not have a reason to think that they would be impacted by PFAS. So we still prioritize geologically vulnerable sources as well as large systems. We sampled systems serving populations of 10,000 or greater in phase two. We sampled approximately 250 community water systems. It was funded through an additional EPA multi-purpose grant. We continued to work with contractors to get the samples collected. And again, all the samples were analyzed using EPA method 533. Phase three of the project began in July of 2022, and the goal of phase three was basically to sample all remaining community water systems at that point. So we had over 500 systems left to sample, and we had no more prioritization or sampling criteria. We wanted to just get all of the community water systems sampled. This round was sampled through an additional EPA multi-purpose grant, as well as Clean Water Fund appropriations. And again, we used contractors and the same EPA method. So looking at the total results from our statewide PFAS testing, we saw that 47% of systems had at least one PFAS detection. And this includes what we refer to as JFLAG data, which is very low level PFAS detections, actually above the laboratory detection limit, but below the reporting limit. So this includes every detection, even if it was very low. I'll mention too, after phase one, the detection rate was higher. It was around 65%, but as we broadened the scope of the project and sampled more systems that were less vulnerable, that percentage went down. So to give you a sense of which PFAS were detected at what frequencies, and look at this chart. PFBA was by far the most widely detected PFAS at 43% of public water systems having a detection. Typically, if a system has any detections of PFAS, it usually includes PFBA or is only PFBA. But we also see other PFAS, PFOA, PFBS, PFHXS, around 16 to 18%. PFPEA, PFHXA, PFOS around 13 to 14%, and PFHPA around 11% of public water systems with detections. So another goal of this project was to create an interactive web dashboard where we could share our PFAS data publicly. So folks can go on this website. It's up and running. You can go on and view any community system in the state and see the status of testing, whether it's been tested for PFAS or not. And then you can see a summary of those results and how they relate to health-based guidance values. We also have some information on how the health-based guidance values are derived and what they mean, and then actions that MDH and systems are taking to reduce PFAS in drinking water. So I've got another flowchart that shows what happens to the results. So once we obtain the results from the lab, we do an initial assessment, and then we communicate those results out to public water systems. Then we plan any actions that are appropriate, which typically is nothing. We had very few systems that actually exceeded any health-based guidance values or that needed to be resampled. And then the results are posted to the public dashboard. So this next slide shows a breakdown of the status and results from the project. So I mentioned that the project is voluntary. So we did attempt to sample 100% of community systems, but we did have a few systems decline to be sampled. Sometimes we had issues scheduling with the system, or they had a well down, and we weren't able to sample them within the project time frame. So we ended up sampling 95% of community water systems, which equates to 99% of community water system customers, or 4.5 million Minnesotans. As I mentioned, we had roughly 47% of systems with a PFAS detection, and that is less than 1% of systems that are above current MDH health-based guidance or exceeding that health risk index, which is 5 systems. As we heard about earlier, we now have draft MCLs for PFAS. So this chart shows what those draft proposed MCLs are. 4 parts per trillion for PFOA and PFAS, and then the hazard index with the other 4 PFAS. So although we only have 5 systems that are currently exceeding our MDH health-based guidance values, we also wanted to mention how many systems we might expect to exceed the draft MCLs, which right now is about 23 systems, or 2.5% of community water systems. And so some of these systems might only have one well that is expected to exceed, and they may have 8 other wells that are not exceeding, while some may have multiple wells that are exceeding or expected to exceed the draft MCLs. We are also expecting our MDH guidance values to be lowered for PFAS and PFOA. We don't yet know what those values will be. So the number that exceed our MDH health-based guidance will likely be higher as well once those values are lowered. So we are working to update the dashboard. We'd like to have 2 different tabs where folks can go on and see how results compare to the MDH health-based guidance values, which we'll update with those new values once they're released, but then also to see how the results compare against the EPA draft MCLs. So next steps on this project, while it's considered completed, we've finished sampling for this project, and we have all the data up on our dashboard. We are planning to do some continued data analysis to assess variables that are potentially influencing PFAS at public water systems, looking at some of the land use surrounding wells and well characteristics to see if we can maybe learn something about which types of wells, which types of systems might be more impacted by PFAS, and how we can incorporate that into our source water protection activities. So last one on my list is the Drinking Water Ambient Monitoring Program, or DWAMP. This is a new programmatic initiative that began just this past summer. So I've talked a lot today about some of our past investigative monitoring work, the statewide PFAS project, UCMP, our pesticide monitoring. Jim spoke about the virus study pathogen project, some of the other investigative monitoring projects that we have done at MDH. And these projects are really considered supplementary to the bread and butter of what we do in drinking water protection, which is compliance work and focusing on contaminants that are regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act. But these projects are also important, and sometimes we are directed to look at some of these contaminants. Sometimes a public health concern arises and we want to put a project together to investigate. And after a decade or so of doing these various projects, we realized that it would be it's important to make this more of a permanent fixture of our program and to establish the framework to do more of this these types of projects on an ongoing basis. So that is the goal of the Drinking Water Ambient Monitoring Program, is to establish an ongoing and permanent capacity to address concerns about public health exposure to CECs, and to support advanced decision-making in securing long-term water resource management, especially for drinking water sources. So I have 4 primary sampling objectives outlined for this project. The next 4 slides will go into each one in a little bit more detail. The first is CEC horizon scanning, then follow-up CEC sampling at systems with low-level CEC detections, watershed scale characterization work. Bob touched on that a little bit earlier today. And then an increased surface water sampling. So the first objective we're referring to as CEC horizon scanning. This is most similar to our past work in similar to the UCMP project, where we'd like to look for a wide range of emerging contaminants in drinking water, groundwater and surface water, not necessarily because there is a public health concern, but just to gain more information on what CECs are we detecting in Minnesota drinking water and at what concentrations. So we'd like to do this as a way to be proactive in our data collection, to get advance notice of any potential public health concerns, to increase our data collection for use in the development of future health-based guidance values for contaminants that don't yet have them. We'd like to have an established network of sites similar to that UCMP program, but also retain the flexibility to add additional sites if needed. So if we hear from our partners at MDA that there's a pesticide that they're detecting, we'd like to be nimble enough to then maybe add additional sites that would allow us to sample for that pesticide if it's used in a certain region, for example. We are planning to hold annual technical meetings with groups that can provide some guidance for us in this area. You know, there are a lot of other monitoring programs at the state, at MPCA and MDA, and we'd really like their input in driving our parameter selection. We don't want to repeat what these other groups are already doing, but to have our work dovetail with what they're doing and also have their work inform our priorities. So objective number two is CEC follow-up sampling. We currently have something called the CEC framework that provides guidance on the level of follow-up that we do at systems that have CEC detections at 25% or greater of any health-based guidance value, but the systems that have lower-level detections at below 25% of those guidance values, we currently aren't following up or resampling. So we'd like to close that gap through this program and be able to revisit some of those systems that have even low-level detections of CECs. Then our third objective is watershed-scale characterization work. So we'd like to sample at a selected group of non-community wells as well as private wells within target watersheds to identify areas and aquifers that are subject to recent recharge and get a better understanding of these areas being vulnerable to contaminants at the ground surface. We're hoping to collect data to fill gaps that are in existing monitoring programs and to increase our knowledge of vulnerable aquifers and regions at the watershed scale, and also increase the data that's collected on private wells since there is a gap there. We're planning to identify watersheds that are at the midpoint of their One Watershed, One Plan planning process and likely identify 3 to 4 watersheds each year. We'll be planning to sample these wells for PFAS, arsenic, nitrate, major cations and anions, bacteria, lead, and manganese, with the option to add on additional analytes if warranted. Then our fourth objective is surface water sampling. We're planning to sample at surface water bodies that directly feed into drinking water systems on a seasonal basis, so roughly 3 times per year, to collect more data and be able to monitor trends over time, just to get a better understanding of water quality at surface water systems. And we're planning to sample these systems for phosphorus, nitrate, chloride, TSS, bacteria, as well as taking field parameters, and then again the option to add on additional analytes if there's a unique need. So as I mentioned, this is a brand new effort within the program. We launched officially this past July, and we're planning to begin sampling this coming spring and summer. So right now we are in the preparation and planning stages. We're still working out the details and determining exactly where we're going to be sampling, exactly what we're sampling for, and starting to have some of these stakeholder meetings, technical meetings to really nail down the details. And so all of this work wouldn't be possible with all of the folks at MDH who have worked on these projects, as well as our partners at USGS and other agencies. So thank you to everyone who's participated in these projects, and happy to take questions if we have any time.
Hi, Jean. Thanks for a great talk. Just curious how you were working to tease out the geologic source lithium from the signal you got in your sampling, since lithium is a really common geologic sourced contaminant in groundwater? Thanks.
Yeah, so we're currently working on that, just starting to really dig into the data and put it on a map, look at different, you know, aquifers and compare different concentrations. We're planning to compare the lithium concentrations against some of our other data, like chloride and tritium, to get a sense of if we can learn anything about the distribution of lithium results based on some of our other data.
In the early stages of this PFAS sampling, you said that you prioritize based on AFFF landfills and spray irrigation. Mm-hmm. So what's the significance of spray irrigation for PFAS?
I think someone from PCA could probably better answer this question than I could, but I think is it wastewater spray irrigation? Is there a thought that there could be PFAS in the water that's applied to the land?
Okay, so wastewater. I got it. Thanks.
Hi, Jane. I'm wondering if you can tell me when PFAS, I'm over here. I wonder if you could tell me when PFAS came on the market and if that's telling you something about the residence time of these waters.
I'm not an expert on any one of these particular chemicals, so I couldn't tell you when PFAS came on the market. I don't know if anyone else has the answer to that.
Yeah, I'm the one bringing the mic around and answering the question here. So ironically on that, early 1950s is when the first formulations came out for it, for PFOA, PFOS, some of the longer chain, shorter chain development continued on into the early to mid 90s, and then some other ones throughout there. So there's about 14,000 currently identified PFAS, somewhere along those lines, depending on what you consider to be fully fluorinated on these guys. So the long, illustrious history.
Hi, so my question is there any action at the state or federal level being taken towards regulating the chemical companies from producing and patenting new PFAS chemicals?
Yeah, again, probably another good question for MPCA. A lot of good questions that I can't necessarily answer.
I'm the guy that my friends always say, should we drink the water? You know, public water systems, my wife, everybody. And I always say, water's great. You know, they do all this testing. But I would love to see a survey of all the people that work at your agency and how many filter their public supply water at home. Because I think I'm going to start after today drinking filtered water. I don't know. It sounds kind of crazy. So I don't know if that's a question for you. Do you use filtered water, Jane? At home?
I feel comfortable drinking the St. Paul water.
Thank you. That's where I want to be.
There was a number of legislations introduced this year relating to the ban on PFAS, including a total ban within the next few years for all non-essential purposes. 3M has stated that they're going to stop production of PFAS as a company-wide by end of 2025, which is not a regulatory or hard deadline, but it is what they have told us. They're still producing that currently at the 3M Cottage Grove facility with very specific ones, even though they discontinued PFOA and PFOS in the early 2000s. But there is work going on right now. We have spun up several new sections and units at the MPCA related to PFAS product testing. We have the new fact sheet on PFAS-free AFFFs that was released this year. There's going to be discontinuation of those as well, but there'll still be some minor uses and, you know, things like pacemakers and things along those lines that will be implanted in people's bodies where you'll still need to use these per- and polyfluoral alkylated substances. But I think it's 2026, 2027, sometime around there. But there's been a ton of new legislation this year related to that ban from the previous question. Not yours, Paul. Also, I don't use a filter, so. I don't. My house is ancient. I still have lead pipes. Supposed to be replacing it soon. I'm just kidding.
Great presentation, Jane. Is there any type of data that would have like a regional distribution of, you know, per se, like when you were showing all the different types of PFAS or even lithium? This is kind of resulting from the UCMP monitoring. Is there any type of map that would show kind of like more of a, like a, like I said, a regional distribution of these contaminants? Like there's more commonly lithium found in this part of the state, or PFAS in like the East Metro and things like that?
Yeah, another good question. We are currently looking into the lithium data. Through the UCMP project, we didn't have a whole lot of systems to work with to really be able to tease out regional effects. Through the data summary report, we did do a little bit of mapping some of the results and grouping by regions. You can check out that data summary report for a little bit of that analysis. But we have a lot of data that we're still digging into as far as the statewide PFAS data and even some of the UCMP data still in that the lithium data set.
Thank you, Jane. There's never...